From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Every spring in California, groups of people travel to the site of a notorious American concentration camp, Manzanar, where Japanese Americans and their families were imprisoned during World War II after being labeled enemy aliens by the U.S. government. Life inside Manzanar and how families attempted to recreate normalcy in the most difficult of times has been well documented by the likes of famous photographers like Dorothea Lange and Ansel Adams. But what about life after Manzanar? How did families who had everything stripped from them reintegrate into society? During our current political moment, when white supremacist government policies invoke the history of Japanese internment, we turn to the author of a new book. Naomi Hirahara is a writer and co-author of Terminal Island and the Lost Communities of Los Angeles Harbor, former editor of the Rafu Shimpo newspaper. Her award-winning mysteries, Mas Arai, have been published in France, Japan, and Korea. She is the co-author with Heather Lindquist of the new book, Life After Manzanar. Welcome to the program, Naomi.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
So first, why was it important for you to and your co-author to focus on what happened to these families after Manzanar? You know, one of it was certainly not the only Japanese internment camp, but it's one that we here in California know really well. And as I said, life inside it was well documented, not as much life after Manzanar.
Well, these individuals who are incarcerated were given $25 each by the government and said, okay, make your way. So as you know, that's a compelling story. So many people who visit the site today, there's a visitor center, they wonder what happened to all these people. At its peak population, there was like 10,000 individuals. One third of them were from Southern California. So, you know, how were they able to, like you say, reintegrate in the mainstream? Well, this book is told more through the stories of people. We followed about 50 individuals, and they all had diverse kind of experiences. They themselves took various political positions, but what they all had in common was this great unknown. The government really didn't want Japanese Americans to bunch up. They were actually told, you know, don't really, you know, hang out with other Japanese Americans. There were certain way stations, like in the interior. Chicago was a big place where the government wanted Japanese Americans to at least temporarily relocate. And to help mitigate these challenges came the Quakers, the American Friends Service Committee, to kind of help them find jobs and housing. But again, it was a huge challenge.
So this, of course, is history that's still so fresh. I mean, there are people all over the country whose grandparents were interned there, and they remember Manzanar. They remember the other internment camps. You said the government gave these folks, the first, of course, made them enter these internment camps, forced them into these spaces, and then separated them, told them they couldn't live together. And as we know, many communities of immigrant origin end up living side by side because of community, because of the kind of familiarity and community that one has with people who speak a similar language and share a culture, and in this case, who shared this horrific experience, but they weren't allowed to retain that sense of community. Why Chicago? You point out that Chicago was a destination. Why did the government suggest the city?
Well, I think it was a large city. It was in the Midwest. So, I mean, that was their kind of initial location that they wanted to target. And what essentially
because happened, it was far from Southern California?
Yes. I mean, no one could return back to the West Coast right away. Mm. So they definitely wanted people more in the interior. And, you know, the East Coast is further away. So, you know, Chicago, I think in their mind, it's a big metropolitan community, but city. But from a community of like 400 Japanese Americans in Chicago, in several months, it ballooned to 20,000. So this funny, demand of the government, it essentially failed. People did not listen to what they were told. They of course they're going to be together because that their families, they've learned to depend on one another. And of course after camp even more so, because they had to share resources, share information, and those kind of things. So in Chicago, there was of course a lack of jobs, a lack of housing. People tended to congregate in a certain area, Clark and Division, that was in the middle of Chicago. Unfortunately, there was a lot of unsupervised young people because those were usually the Nisei, the second generation, were the first to leave camp. And without that supportive family, people, some individuals did get in trouble. There were a lot of babies out of wedlock. There's incidents of abortion, as well as there was someone who was apprehended who was a stick-up man. There was gambling. So these are kind of
The
stories
things that
we
happen when a community is traumatized, in other words.
exactly. And I think also what's interesting, you mentioned like the grandchildren who hear, who are kind of coming to the grips of this story for so long. I for various reasons, the elders, they were just trying to survive. So they weren't really talking about what had happened to them during World War II to their children or grandchildren. So it's only, until like probably 1980s where, the faucet of repressed emotion and experiences were opened during these redress and reparation commission hearings, and grown men were crying, and people were, even people who are very young who are born in camp, they didn't even realize they were born in a concentration camp. They thought it was a labor camp because they were never told. And then they go to places like UC Berkeley and during the civil rights movement, and they, for the first time, realize what had happened to them and their family.
Right. I mean, this is really interesting because we might look back, if we don't know enough about the internment of Japanese Americans, we might imagine that the government sort of came to its senses, or maybe a lawsuit forced it to relent, and suddenly it was accepted that what was done was wrong, so people were freed. But it wasn't like that. Even after people were told to leave the camp, given rules about how to leave the camp, there was never truly an admission of what was done, right? And weren't these Japanese Americans going back to an American society that still treated them as, quote, enemy aliens with suspicion and with racism?
One of our subjects, Hank Umemoto, was raised in a farm. Then he went to Manzanar, and then he and his mother and siblings lived on Skid Row in downtown LA. And he, walked over drunks, or he walked past, brothels. But he said that was nothing compared to kind of the psychic things, the racism that he experienced, like what just, not being barred from going to a movie theater, and this is after World War II, or being relegated to a seat next to the bathroom on the train. He said those were the things that really were the most challenging for him emotionally. So I think that's an important part of the story. There were, people, a lot of people were in actually barracks or trailers in temporary housing throughout Southern California. So in a sense, they're from one camp to another kind. And we're talking about the poorest of the poor, the most disenfranchised of those who are incarcerated. There were some other people who are lucky enough to have good neighbors and other people, good advocates, legal advocates, and they were able to hold on to their property. And of course, all these other families lived with them. It became an unofficial hostel. But in terms of the poorest of the poor, and they were the last to leave Manzanar, these were people who left, the war ended in August, and they actually didn't leave camp until November because they didn't know where they were going. So there's kind of these like dual aspects of the story, the more emotional as well as political side, as well as just the
Right.
physical situation.
What about the stripping away of their economic rights? I mean, what happened to the property of these families when they were relegated to and imprisoned in Manzanar, and were they ever returned any of their property?
There were certain people who had access to attorneys and lawyers, and there are individual cases where they were able to get their property, but most of them, even if you own property, we all have to pay property tax, and if you're unable to come up with that money, you're going to lose it. There was some legislation due to Japanese Americans fighting for it right after war, that they were able to get certain amount of their losses compensated back to them, but it was like pennies on the dollar. It was not much at all.
So because they were imprisoned, they couldn't work to pay their property taxes. Their property was sort of taken away from them through this legal and technical loophole.
Exactly. And some people had their assets in a Japanese bank, right? And though their assets were frozen, so how were they going to? So there was all those a multitude of challenges. But what was really illuminating for me working on this book was all throughout, even from the time they were released, there were certain leaders who were constantly challenging anti-alien land laws. Japanese Issei immigrants could not get citizenship until 1952. And there were also, during the McCarthy era, they were trying to kind of use the things that were targeted towards Japanese Americans towards like communists, like to make it possible maybe to round up people because of their political beliefs. So there were always certain individuals who are constantly fighting against these kind of proposals. And so it wasn't just a thing, finally we got redress and reparations in the late 80s, but it wasn't a sudden thing. It wasn't an incidental thing. It was something that was constantly being worked on over all these decades. And Manzanar itself, because now it's a National Historic Site, that's all part of the journey and fight that happened.
And people fought for everything that they did. They did end up winning. I mean, none of it was given voluntarily by the government, of course. You write in your book about how some of the folks who had and who either were born in Manzanar or grew up there or had parents there, really did end up sort of identifying themselves as having had this experience and used their experience to fight for and to become political, to fight for rights of Americans, and particularly Americans were seen as the other in the eyes of the government. And the political moment we're in today makes this conversation all the more important. Tell us about these activists who emerged from that history.
Yeah, it's really exciting to me. There's two younger activists. One is a grandson of a World War II veteran and with the Military Intelligence Service, but his own mother helped. She represented an individual who filed a lawsuit, and it went all the way to Supreme Court. He lost his, that was challenging like the exclusion orders during the war. He lost his case, but later these younger people, like this young man's mother during the 80s, they came together to kind of challenge the Supreme Court's decision because there had been information that came out that the government was intentionally suppressing evidence that showed that there was no cases of espionage. So he's part of this long line, and he himself is a po involved with the arts and involved with he has this great sign that says "No more Manzanar" that he used in the Women's March, and he and another descendant of Manzanar survivors, a poet. They've come together with other people in conjunction with Muslim Americans to fight against the Muslim ban, Islamophobia, and they do it in such a creative way, not only through marches, but also in breaking bread together, kind of learn go you know going to the breaking in the end of Ramadan, so to really make it to create experiences where we learn about each other as well as support people who are their future is jeopardized. They may not be Japanese Americans, but we totally relate to what they have gone through because of our historic experiences during World War II.
Naomi, any personal connection for you with this book?
It's more through my actually parents were atomic bomb survivors. They were in Hiroshima. That's a whole nother story. So in a weird way, I'm a kind of an outsider. I look like an insider, but I'm kind of an outsider. But my extended family were in camp. They were in a camp in Arkansas. So all these hot spots, right? The swamplands of Arkansas, the deserts of California. But I always think to myself, if I was alive during World War II, I would, even though I was born here in America, I would have been in a camp. So just that connection makes me committed to tell the story.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and shining a light on this history and everything that's come after. Thanks so much. My guest has been Naomi Hirahara, fiction and nonfiction writer. We've been discussing the new book she's co-written with Heather Lindquist called Life After Manzanar. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.